Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Brian Morris, filling in this week for News Director Sean Corcoran. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And joining us a bit later will be Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Also joining us in studio this morning is Sam Houghton of the Mashpee Enterprise. Good morning, Sam.
All right.
Let's see. Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette will be checking in later. Josh Bowling of the managing editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll also hear from Josh. Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner. Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times. And George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's start by taking a look at some local news around the Cape and Islands. And Cindy, police have now determined that reckless driving was the cause of that really awful fatal crash last December that claimed the lives of two Falmouth High School students.
Yeah, this was a crash that, you know, really broke hearts in Falmouth. This is two teenage hockey players, James Lavin and Owen Higgins. They're both 17. Now, state reconstruction teams say that Lavin was driving recklessly and speeding just before that crash. That was December 22nd, like I said, just before Christmas. They were leaving a hockey practice at the Falmouth Ice Arena, and they're on a wooded and winding section of Thomas B. Landers Road. That's located between Gegget and Sam Turner Roads. The car went off the road, hit a tree. Mm-hmm. Lavin died at the scene, and Higgins died the next day at Hasbro Children's Hospital in Rhode Island. And now, according to the investigation, Lavin illegally passed another vehicle over a double yellow line, and that's when he lost control.
And the road, I understand, was wet at the time, but there was no ice.
Yeah, right? Wet, no ice.
Right.
But just a tragic.
Right, was a tragic thing. Also, another story making news, a group of South Truro residents have lost their appeal to overturn an occupancy permit for a controversial house that's been controversial up in Truro for quite some time. This has been going on for many years, Cindy.
Yeah, this was known as the Klein House, yes, and it's been in the courts and for quite a while. It's been in legal proceedings for quite a while. Now, what happened was a group of neighbors are going to be headed to Barnstable Superior Court to fight occupancy of this building. It was an 8,000 square foot house. Mm-hmm. It's kind of sleek and modern, glass and concrete, but one of the issues is that this didn't really fit in at the time that it was built with the neighborhood, which was considered like at the territory of famous painter Edward Hopper. He had a slumber place next door, and so But what happens is this group of neighbors has lost their appeal to overturn the occupancy permit, and that was occupancy permit was actually issued in December, and they're now headed to Barnstable Superior Court. This is following the March 27th Zoning Board of Appeals ruling that is granting an occupancy permit. And there's, like you said, there's this long history to this building.
Right.
And at one point, the State Appeals Board ruling led to a revocation of the building permits for the property in 2012, and the house has stood empty as the property owners in the town were tied up in court. But, you know, the interesting thing that happened with this case that the property owners are really objecting to is in December, the selectman reached a settlement with the property owners that pardons the zoning violations and allows the current owners, Thomas Dennis and Kathleen Whitehead Dennis, to live in the house. But that's as long as they pay over $400,000 in zoning fines and a $2.5 million donation to the town.
And they've already... they've paid that first installment, correct?
They paid the first installment, yeah. But the Robert Shapiro, the attorney for the neighbor, says that this gives the appearance that the town is for sale. So
And
so this continues to be controversial and continues to be headed for more legal proceedings.
I'm sure we haven't heard the last of this story.
That's right.
Yeah. Sam Houghton from the Mashpee Enterprise joins us in the studio this morning. Good morning, Sam.
All right.
And Sam, it looks like it looks as though the sport of pickleball may soon be coming to the town of Mashpee. First of all, what is pickleball?
Yeah, okay. Pickleball, it's gotten more and more popular, as from what I've been told, I think in the senior community. But it's really kind of a combo of badminton, tennis, and ping pong, which is kind of interesting. It's actually kind of a wiffle ball and a wooden racket.
And not quite as challenging as tennis, maybe, so it's a bit easier for folks.
Yeah, well, I think it's on a smaller court than tennis, so
okay.
it's you don't have to run as much, but I think at the same time, it might be faster pace. So there is no pickle in it. it was actually, from what I was told, it was the creator of the sport named it after his dog Pickles, who kept getting the ball and running away.
Okay. Makes sense.
But so last night, the town, the DPW director, went in front of the CPC to, you know, with this project of six pickleball courts in downtown Mashpee, right around the corner from Town Hall. CPC is yet to decide what they're going to do with it. They're going to kick it down the road a little bit. But, you know, there's strong support, obviously, from the pickleball community for this. They're also kind of the, I don't know if you want to say downside, but this is going on top of what has been the community garden project.
And this, the reason is because it's just kind of lack of use of the community
garden. Yeah, I think they had thought at the time, they thought this was, would be a really popular thing. That's kind of, you might say it was a trend then. It was in 2009 when they decided to do that, also with CPC money. It just hasn't caught on. You know, the DPW is spending a lot of time weeding there, and she's saying, well, let's put this to better use. But so we'll see. It still has to go through the CPC. It also has to go through town meeting before anything is done. That would be in October. But, you know, it also has to go through historic district. But, you know, it could be six pickleball courts in downtown Mashpee, which would be kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Also, Sam, a resolution between residents of New Seabury and Mashpee. What's going on with that proceeding?
Yeah, this is a story I've been reporting on for over a year now. But in July, members filed a class action lawsuit against the New Seabury owners and management, saying that the club kind of introduced these new memberships that, you know, put a lot of current members that thought were kind of coerced into these memberships unfairly. And so they filed, after negotiating back and forth and getting nowhere, they decided to file in Superior Court under the Consumer Protection Act. After a year or so, or I guess a little less, they finally have come to a resolution that the judge signed off on the settlement agreement last week. But, you know, going forward, I think with any settlement, neither side can ever be happy, really.
Right.
But, you know, I think this is really an opportunity for the two sides to, you know, move forward after, you know, what's been a pretty bitter you know, back and forth.
Is this a final resolution to this, Sam, or is there still some?
It looks like it's, I think there's still a couple I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed, but really the judge signed off on it. There has been no objections. The judge actually agreed to hold off on what's called a fairness hearing, which would have given anyone an opportunity to speak against this. You know, his reasoning was there have been no objections filed within the timeline they had been filed. So, you know, he's saying, okay, we're not going to get any objections, so let's just get this over with and go forward.
All right. We'll see what happens on that. Sam Houghton of the Mashpee Enterprise, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Cindy, a lot of work happening over at the Barnstable Municipal Airport these days. I understand they're building a new runway, doing repair work and all kinds of other things.
And that could lead to some delays this spring and summer. There's a reconstruction project that will make one of the airport's two main runways unusable most of the summer season. And that's called Runway 1533, and it's mainly used during the winter due to prevailing winds, but occasionally in the summer, depending on weather conditions. Now, as part of this $9.5 million project that started last month, the runway will be closed from May 24th to at least August 5th.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this going to, you know, you drive by there, as I've done recently, and it's really, they're well underway with piles of dirt and all kinds of stuff. This is, I think, the third busiest airport in New England. And is the, how's this going to affect this?
Yeah, just after Logan and Nantucket.
Right. Now, how's this going to affect the summer traffic? I'm reading here that they're saying it's going to, you know, airlines are not predicting any big delays, but
like I said, it will be based on weather because that runway is usually used mainly in the winter, not so much in the summer. But it depends on which way the winds are blowing. Sometimes they do use it in the summer. So if it's a time when they would have used it and they can't, that could cause some delays. Now the other runway, which is called 624, will be open all summer except for 9 days in May, and during that time, that runway that will be closed most of the summer will be open. But well, during the day, but the airport will be effectively closed at night during that time period, that short time period.
And it won't affect the JetBlue service that's resuming in June, I guess?
I'm not sure about that. Like I said, the weather delays. Sure. If there are weather conditions that would cause for the runway to be put in service that's normally used in the winter, that could affect. That could have some challenges.
Well, construction well underway at the airport. We have Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette joining us on the phone. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Ryan.
And we have, Sarah, you have some wrap-ups to tell us about a couple of town meetings that have been happening on island this week.
Yeah, they're actually happening next week with town meeting season. Yeah, kicking off, we have the Vineyard Super Tuesday of sorts with Edgartown, Oak Bluffs, and West Tisbury all holding their annual town meeting.
Yeah, let's talk about Oak Bluffs first.
Oak Bluffs is kind of of course, there's lots going on in all the towns, but Oak Bluffs has a lot of hot-button issues on the ballot. I've heard discussions that the meeting might go at least two nights, maybe more. And the big issues there are several things, but they include a proposal to build a new town hall with a price tag of about $9.9 million. And this has been a matter of debate in Oak Bluffs for the last few years. And town meeting voted to fund a new town hall, I think back in 2014, but the proposal failed at the ballot box. So it's back again, and town leaders are really telling voters that they think it's the time. The current town hall was built as a school more than 50 years ago, and the building inspector has noted a list of deficiencies, malfunctioning heat and air conditioning and the like. So we'll see if voters approve of that this go-around.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and then down the street, the Island Theater is also a matter of debate. This one, there's kind of a less clear image of what the town wants to do, but it's about a century-old theater. It's been vacant for several years, and the building inspector and a board of survey and an independent inspector have all deemed it a public safety hazard because it's in such poor shape. And there's a proposal on the warrant to spend about $200,000 for kind of somewhat temporary repairs to brace it so it's a little bit safer for the summer season. The plan is to recoup the money through liens because it is privately owned. But I know that there are some in town who advocate for demolition or other measures, so I think that could be a wide-ranging discussion next Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. And any other possible uses under consideration for that if it does get rehabbed? Or?
There's really, because it's privately owned right now, so there's kind of that debate of, you know, once it's, if it's, right now, I think the real focus is making it safe.
Right.
So, you know, that they don't have to worry about it being a public safety hazard.
Right.
And then once, I think the debate might go from there as far as what the future might hold, as far as any uses for it.
Yeah. Oak Bluffs is also considering following the lead of some Cape Cod towns by banning plastic bags in checkout lines.
Yeah. And this is interesting because last year, all the towns on the Vineyard except for Oak Bluffs voted to ban the single-use plastic bags. And this in Oak Bluffs had kind of postponed it, saying that they wanted to have a bit more discussion with the business community there. And there were some discussions between the Vineyard Conservation Society, which is the group that put this on the ballot in the other towns, and the business community, but they couldn't really come to a consensus. So there are now two different plastic bag ban proposals on the warrant. There's kind of some differences between them, including the thickness of the plastic and what would be permitted as far as the actual bags themselves. So I think there will be a lot of discussion about that, too, as far as, clarifying what the difference is and also what voters decide that they want for that ban.
Okay, just briefly, Edgartown is going to decide whether or not to take ownership of a rundown house
mm-hmm.
in town.
Yeah, kind of a somewhat similar issue to the Island Theater in the sense they're actually owned by the same owners. And this is a vacant building in poor shape right on Main Street next to Town Hall. And the town is proposing purchasing or taking the building by eminent domain for $3 million, finding a tenant to fix it up, maybe operate it as a retail space. This has been a matter of debate in town for several years, you know, what's happening with the property. There's some concerns about some legal wrangling that's been going on with the property that's been costing the town for several years. The owner of the house and the Island Theater, I should say, you know, has spoken against it and said that he has other plans for the property and wants to work with the town in that regard. But I expect that there will be a lot of discussion about that and that your town is kind of the big issue on the warrant.
Okay. Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Bye. Yep. And we're going to take a short break right now. We'll have more of the Friday News Roundup when we return. Welcome back. This is the Friday News Roundup on The Point, and we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Brian Morris, and with me in our Woods Hole studio this morning is Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. And Cindy, the nursing education program at Cape Cod Community College has just gotten a nice little financial boost.
Yeah, Cape Cod 5-Cent Savings Bank has announced that they're giving the community college a grant of $250,000 for the new nursing center. And this, so right now they've raised about half of the $3.7 million that they need. And they're planning on opening this new teaching center by fall. They've already got $1 million from Cape Cod Healthcare, which also has pledged to hire the graduates. And they have other donations out there, including a state grant of $350,000.
This is an ambitious expansion of an already pretty ambitious program, which is really wonderful.
Yeah, the nursing program is very popular, and this is located in the North Building, and they plan on doubling the teaching size by the fall. So this is, like you said, an ambitious project, and the goal is also to increase the number of nursing students. So right now there are 64 full-time day and 32 part-time evening students. And they plan to increase the program until it has 32 more students each year, and they'll be, you know, so the goal is to, you know, prepare students for good-paying jobs, you know, mm-hmm. allow young people to be able to stay on the Cape, and all working people who are looking for this type of job in allied health to stay on the Cape, and also supply much-needed nurses to the hospitals and nursing homes and other and doctor's offices on the Cape, so needed, especially as the Cape ages.
Absolutely. All right. Let's go now to Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, you there? Good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
Tim, the ever-changing shoreline down around Lighthouse Beach in that area just keeps right on changing.
Sure. It's very dynamic, and we saw an example of that this past weekend. About a half mile south of Lighthouse Beach, there was a washover area on South Beach that people have been keeping their eyes on for several months now. And in the storm we had on April 1st, the heavy northeast winds really pushed the tide over that and blew out what little sand remained in that washover area. By the next day, boats were going through that break, which now measures at least 150 feet wide at low tide, quite a bit more at high tide. Now, town officials and officials from the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies, they say that this looks like it's establishing itself pretty quickly and is likely here to stay. Now, there's a couple of serious implications of this development. One involves access to Chatham Harbor and Pleasant Bay through the main inlet to the harbor, which is just adjacent to this new break. Now, that original inlet formed in 1987 has been narrowing and getting more and more difficult to navigate over the past few years. If less water is flowing through that inlet because some is being funneled through the new break, it's possible that original entrance is going to show up even more. This is a critical issue because it's the major route to the open ocean for the town's commercial fishing fleet from the town's fish pier, which
yeah,
is
that could be a real disaster north. For them. Yeah, that could be.
Yeah. The other potential problem for this new break is, this is sort of the beginning of the breakup of South Beach, which is what's predicted to happen as far as the Barrier Beach system in Chatham is concerned. And now this could be a little bit down the road, but eventually all the sand is going to go away, and you could open up a whole section of shoreline to erosion and impacts from the open ocean. Now, in what turns out to be a remarkable case of prescience, the Center for Coastal Study recently put a tidal gauge at Outermost Harbor Marine, which is right in the inner shore near this new break, which will allow them to measure the tidal changes in that section of the harbor. As the break becomes more established, and they'll have a good set of data to look at and maybe make some predictions about what's going to happen there. Now, it's not all bad news, however.
Right, because, silver lining, yeah.
Right, pardon me?
A silver lining for some other boaters.
If you're a boater who likes to go to the open ocean from Nantucket Sound and this new break remains navigable, it's a much bigger shortcut than having to go around Monomoy. So people are cautious about that, whether that is even going to stay open for the summer, if it's still going to be navigable. But they're looking forward to maybe at least a season of some easy navigation through there.
Right. All right. And also, Tim, Chatham representatives were in Washington this week to testify about a border dispute involving the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge just beneath the area that we've just been talking about.
Indeed. Now, this has been going on for over a year now. The town and the Fish and Wildlife Service are disputing the western boundary of Monomoy, which the town says should be the low tide mark, but Fish and Wildlife in their recent management plan for Monomoy incorporated about 3,000 acres of submerged lands in Nantucket Sound and said that that's our territory, and the town and the state are saying, well, you've never claimed that in 70 years, so we dispute that. So Representative William Keating filed a bill on behalf of the town to set that boundary at the low water line. And on Wednesday, a group of town officials went to Washington, and Selectman Seth Taylor testified before the House Subcommittee on Federal Lands, which is looking at that legislation. Now, Taylor told us that he pretty much laid out the town's case for the bill, fielded several questions from committee members. He said the discussion seemed to go along party lines, with Democrats praising the Fish and Wildlife Service, and Republicans being a bit more sympathetic to the town's concern over overreach of a federal agency.
Yeah,
he said that he expects the bill to be reported favorably out of this subcommittee, although we're not sure when that'll happen. He thinks that'll go along party lines, and he says if the bill remains as a standalone legislation and isn't attached to any other bill, he thinks it could get through Congress and move on to the Senate. Now, the town is pursuing a couple other avenues to try to resolve the situation. One is the state attorney general has said that she will file suit against the federal government over this issue. And the other is an administrative solution, talking with the Fish and Wildlife, trying to get them to change the management plan. But Taylor said that's kind of a hard sell right now because, first of all, there's no new head of the Fish and Wildlife Service. It hasn't been appointed yet by the administration, so they really don't have anybody to talk to yet. So the town's going to keep going on these three tacks, and at least Taylor is very adamant that something's got to be done to resolve the situation.
Yeah, complex issue all around. Tim Wood is editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Brian. See you later.
Okay, you too. Cindy, this is kind of a yearly ritual. The North Atlantic right whales have once again been spotted in Cape Cod Bay.
Yeah, and there's good news. There are two calves that were spotted. There was a mother and a calf pair in Cape Cod Canal, and another that was spotted by observers and airplanes between Race Point, Provincetown, and Marshfield.
Yeah, this is really an amazing thing, and we've done some coverage here where we've actually gone out on boats and seen these right whales right up close, and it's just an unbelievable thing to see. And it's not just the calves; there have been more spotted, correct?
They spotted 75 whales in all on Monday, and that's the most seen so far this season. And now there are North Atlantic right whales are endangered population. They number 520. Four, and one third to one half of them make their way to the Cape Cod Bay in the summer for to eat and socialize and nurse their young. So Charles Stormy Mayo, who's at the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies, said, yeah, you can expect to see more and more coming in over the next few weeks.
And they winter down off Florida and Georgia.
Florida and Georgia. So they've made, these mother and calf pairs have made quite the journey up here. And this is the eighth documented birth for a North Atlantic right whale named Padiddle. And she was spotted, her male calf was spotted rolling and slapping his tail as mom fed underwater, according to Allison Olgavy of the Center for Coastal Studies in P-Town. So, they were just frolicking and enjoying the Cape Cod spring.
Happy to be back.
Right. Happy to be back.
Like snowbirds, yeah. Yeah.
And there's one other good piece of whale news also. This is about a humpback whale named Echo. And she was, people feared, whale observers feared that she died in September after becoming entangled in fishing gear. But the first whale watch of the season spotted her in Stellwagen Bank, and she looked fine.
Great.
So that was good news.
Well, there we go. That's great. All right. On the phone with us right now is Josh Bolling, managing editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, Nantucket wrapped up. The town meeting is happening this week. What were some of the major results of that or the articles?
Right. We did wrap it up. We had a one-day town meeting on Saturday. It took about 7 hours. We've had town meetings on Saturdays the last few years. There were 113 articles on the warrant. 17 of them were called for debate. And the big issue was a proposal to spend about $30 million on the construction of a new town-owned nursing home and another $2.5 million to purchase property on which to build it outside of the downtown area. The current facility, just about everyone agrees, is in need of reconstruction. It sits just outside downtown on the Nantucket waterfront. But voters decided that the Mid-Island location was not the right one, and the $30 million price tag was not a price they're willing to pay, so they defeated that proposal. There'd been some contention about the proposal heading into town meeting. Opponents of the Mid-Island location said they'd prefer to see it stayed on the downtown waterfront. They don't believe that enough questions were answered about the viability of doing that. Supporters of the move, including the majority of town officials, argued that it would be basically impossible to build a new facility on the waterfront while the existing facility was still open, therefore necessitating moving the about 40 or so elderly residents there, probably to mainland nursing homes, and furloughing or laying off the staff. But it appears to be back to the drawing board if the town wants to build a new nursing home for the 40 or so residents.
Yeah, any sense of what might happen next, or when a new effort might be undertaken for this?
It's a little early to tell. I got the sense that the town officials who had proposed this were nursing their wounds a little bit. They weren't happy about this. They felt they had done all they could. The more practical view seems to be that they will go back to the drawing board, perhaps bring a proposal forward for a fall special town meeting. Town meetings in the fall in Nantucket aren't so special anymore. We seem to have one every year. But that's certainly a possibility as well. Again, the consensus on the island seems to be that the town should be in the business of operating a municipal nursing home for its elderly residents. There's about 40 there now. There's often a waiting list, and the island population is not getting any younger, so it's an issue that's going to remain for quite some time.
Also this week, elections with selectmen's race, of course, with neither one of the incumbents on that running in that race.
No, our election, annual town election, is coming up on Tuesday. The polls will be open at Nantucket High School from 7 in the morning until 8 at night. And the selectman race tops the list, but there are five contested races this year. Just about every major board and commission on the island has a contested race, which hasn't happened in some time. The selectman, again, right at the top there, there's six candidates running for those two open seats. Neither incumbent chose to seek re-election. But there are also two people running for a seat on the planning board, three people running for two seats on the school committee, four people running for two seats on the historic district commission, two people running for a seat on the land bank. I apologize.
That's
that
okay.
Many races, I get them confused.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of things to keep straight there. All right. Well, we'll see what happens with that. Josh Bolling is managing editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good to talk to you, Josh. Thanks.
Thanks.
Okay. Let's go now to Ann Wood, editor of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ann.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Cindy.
And voters in Provincetown this week, by pretty wide margin, they approved plans for a long-awaited new police station.
Yeah, it's a pretty exciting margin. By 206-4 and 35 opposed, we got the two-thirds majority needed to build a new police station, which is going to be in a different location from the one that we have now. This is backs up on Route 6 at 16 Jerome Smith Road, and it's pretty exciting because it's taken like 7 years or more for the town to like come up with a place for this police station. It's gone through a number of locations, all of which the town people argued against. So for everybody to come out and go for the station, which is going to be about $8.6 million, and it's pretty exciting.
What was it about this latest location, the one that got approved, that people liked over the others?
I think it's because it's by the highway, and it's also on a town-owned property that was given to the town by the state for a fire station quite a while ago. That never happened, so the idea that this greenway that is back right up on the highway is easy entry and access for the police, but it's also good for the town because it frees up other town-owned land that the town's been looking at for community and affordable housing.
Okay. Also, and the Harbor Hill condominium complex, which the town is hoping to use as year-round affordable rentals, still has a few hurdles to overcome before that's a done deal.
Yeah, the 26-unit Harbor Hill condominium complex, which had been used as a timeshare and had timeshare owners, there was kind of a wrench thrown in this deal that the town has a committee, which is a year-round rental fund committee that is looking to build median income housing for the townspeople here, because there's just no housing available, even if you earn between $47,000 and $107,000. The town decided that it would try to go for this this Harbor Hill condominium complex that was in bankruptcy court, and it bid $8.1 million, and that was the highest bidder. A wrench was thrown in when this group called Lemon Cheese Capital, apparently 4 days before the bids were due in bankruptcy court, bought two timeshare units for basically $5,000 each. Now, as owners, Lemon Juice Capital is claiming that the town doesn't have a right to buy it in bankruptcy court, and the town also doesn't have a right to buy it outright on the free market. It's like throwing a wrench into the whole process. So now, Lemon Juice, because of Lemon Juice's claim that the sale doesn't represent the interval owners, the judge, Joan Feeney of U.S. Bankruptcy Court in Boston, decided that it needs to go to Mass Land Court to clear up title questions about ownership of the timeshare development before it can go back to bankruptcy court and decide what will happen to the property.
Hmm. Any sense of how long, what kind of a timeline we're looking at for a resolution here?
This week, the town manager, David Panagor, and the board of selectmen, who's one of the housing trustees, Tom Donegan, said they have no idea about the date of the the land court hearing, and they don't know how long the process will take. So the idea was that they hoped to get it about a month or two ago, and then they were going to start working on it right away so they could move people in, but by the fall. So apparently that's not going to happen for quite a while.
All right. Ann Wood, editor of the Provincetown Banner, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Bye.
Okay. And let's take a quick break, and when we return, we'll have more from the News Roundup. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Brian Morris, joined in our Woods Hole studio this morning by Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. Cindy, in Sandwich, the former owner of Joe's Lobster Mart is looking to open a new establishment, but it's unclear when or if he may be able to do that.
And Joseph Votto plans to open Mr. Votto's Fish Market, but it's likely to face some roadblocks when he's applying for some necessary state permits. As you recall, Votto was forced to shut down Joe's Lobster Mart in 2014 when the state revoked his license to sell fish and shellfish after he pleaded guilty to charges of receiving stolen oysters. So I'm right. And the State Division of Marine Fisheries sent a letter to him in 2015 saying they would take his conviction and seafood practices into consideration if he made future applications to be a wholesale dealer and to get a fish shipper's permit. So, and according to our reporter, Votto has not yet requested an inspection from the DPH, an inspection that is required, and he and the state Fisheries Division says they have received no license application from him at this point. He also still needs a final certificate of occupancy from the town.
Yeah, so this is really a lot of things going on here with this that might...
Yeah, and even more because he remains in the middle of a lawsuit filed by his former general manager, Scott Thayer. Scott Thayer says that when he took over Joe's Lobster Mart for a brief period after it was closed, that Votto moved money from the credit card sale to his own bank account. And Votto is countersuing.
Okay. All right. Another story making news. Cindy, we have a report of a new violation at or new official citing workers at Pilgrim for another episode that happened this week.
Yeah, operators at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth failed to follow standard procedure last week, and that caused water to flood from a massive storage tank into the reservoir at the base of the reactor. The problem was the incorrect alignment of some valves. This occurred during a prep for refueling. Workers on April 1st opened a valve out of sequence in the reactor reservoir pool without first closing the valve in the water storage tank. And that is apparently there was like no real big safety concerns at that time because of this occurrence. But David Lockbaum, who's the director of Nuclear Safety Project for the Union of Concerned Scientists, said that such mistakes do not build public confidence.
Yeah, just another in the latest long string of incidents over at the Pilgrim.
Right, and it's scheduled to close in mid-June of 2019.
That's right. All right, we have Jim DeRuda standing by from the New Bedford Standard-Times. Good morning, Jim.
Brian.
And Jim, there was a big immigration forum yesterday that happened down at Dover at UMass Dartmouth involving two very high-profile personalities who've really been quite a lot in the news lately on this immigration issue.
Yeah, at the UMass Dartmouth School of Law, they ran a symposium with four different panels, each one of them was like a home run. They were really good. The one you're talking about specifically was a panel discussion on sanctuary cities, and it included not only a councilwoman from the city of Newton, Emily Norton, where the community just turned itself into a welcoming city, trying to get away from the politically loaded phrase of sanctuary city, and our refugee advocacy coalition federal policy director was there, Saran Sekavat, and the two top panelists, though, or the two that got the most attention, were our Bristol County Sheriff, Thomas Hodgson, who has been in the news quite a bit because he recently called for officials in sanctuary cities who keep illegal immigrants, this is his language, keep illegal immigrants from the federal government, should be arrested. And sitting a couple seats down from him was Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone, who had responded to public expression by the sheriff with a Facebook post that said the sheriff is a, quote, jackbooted thug who wants to jail your political opponents for made-up offenses. Now, it's very interesting how civil the conversation was, and it provided because it was so civil, it provided a very clear difference between the message that the sheriff tries to present and the message that the other three folks on the panels were trying to prevent. It was very interesting. The other three panels, one was number of alumni who talked about what it's like to be an immigration lawyer, and that was fascinating to hear about how complex and how confusing and fluid and ripe for mistakes the whole legal immigration process is. And they talked about how paralegals and non-lawyer immigration facilitators can hardly approach an understanding of what it takes to win immigration decisions and hearings in court. And the day was capped with former Congressman Barney Frank, who talked about the importance of voting, sovereignty of the people of the United States, the uselessness of whining about the 2016 election results. And he said he doesn't believe a wall will be built and that Congress and courts are doing their job holding the fort, supporting America's moral imperative.
Wow. So it seems like a great, well-organized kind of an event. Do you think people came away from it appreciative that it took place?
I have no doubt. I think that the law school, by really putting high-quality folks on all of the panels, really did a great service. And there were some folks there applauding and clapping when the sheriff spoke, and then there were plenty on the other side, including a handful of folks who were protesting out by the street before that Sanctuary Cities panel, and they came in and joined so they could hear what the sheriff had to say and what the other folks on the panel, particularly Mayor Curtatone, had to say.
Yeah, and I understand the sheriff and the mayor shook hands at the end of the panel, so that's yeah.
Indeed. No, they really had a civil conversation. They listened to one another. They agreed with one another on many points, which was, you know, that gets right at the root of so many of the political issues we're looking at today, that some folks use it imprecise or general language, and some people rely on very specific language, and unless there's a sort of a translator in between those two, we're having a hard time moving forward. But that was present yesterday.
Well, a good event, especially on such a timely issue. So that's good to hear that worked out that way. Jim Deruta is editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times. Jim, great story today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Let's turn now to George Brennan, editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George. Welcome back to the Roundup.
Good morning, Brian. It's good to be back. And hello, Cindy, my old friend.
Hello.
Old home week here. That's on
right.
The Roundup, yeah. George, police chiefs on Ireland are seeking to clear up some confusion this week about their policy on detaining immigrants. Nice, you know, feed in from that last story with Jim.
Yeah, well, there was some confusion among Islanders here over this. There's an island-wide initiative that's going to be on the town meeting warrants that are coming up. And so we had a story last week, and, you know, some of the police chiefs were saying, look, we don't know why this is on the warrant. We don't really have any control over immigration. That's federal law. And so they didn't see the need for this. Well, this past week, there was a meeting between the police chiefs and some of the folks who are pushing for this from We Stand Together. And they cleared the air at that meeting. Everybody's feeling much better about things. Essentially, what this does, this town meeting warrant does, is put into writing what the police already do. They don't detain people for any immigration violations. That's not their role. If someone commits a crime and they happen to be here illegally, then that opens up a whole nother thing. But in terms of actual immigration violations and things like that, that's in the federal purview and not with the police departments here on Martha's Vineyard.
And again, it seems like, just as in Jim's story about the forum at UMass yesterday, that it's just a case of once things are sort of codified and maybe put in writing and, you know, detailed a little bit better, that helps to clear up the air a lot.
You know, communication is yeah. So important. And this group did meet with the police chiefs back in January to tell them what they were going to do. But then there was sort of a drop in communication. And the next thing the police chiefs were hearing was that this was on the town meeting warrants. And so, you know, as always, communication clears things up.
Right, right. All right, George, another story making news this week, the removal of some pear trees in Vineyard Haven.
Yeah, nothing can get people going in any story like an animal or a tree that's being taken down. And in this case, it's on Clow Lane, and it's two pear trees, and these are on, you know, private property, but still folks were hoping to somehow try to save these trees from being taken down. The homeowner, though, Carol White, says, you know, there's a danger here to her property. In storms, these trees are particularly brittle, and limbs come down and, you know, could damage her home. So that's why she wants to take them down. Where it stands now is, even though the town really doesn't have the authority, they did say that she could take them down. But we were talking about this in the newsroom this morning, and we're not sure it's over until, you know, the chainsaw fires up. You know, there could be another chapter to this, so stay tuned.
Okay. All right, George Brennan, editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Great to talk to you, Brian, and take care, Cindy.
And congrats, George.
Thank you. Thank
okay.
You.
And Cindy, some news out of Falmouth this week. The town meeting has approved plans for a senior center.
Yeah, town meeting members voted Wednesday to spend $9.5 million for the new senior center. It will replace the 40-year-old facility on Dillingham Avenue and be located on the Gus Cantee Community Center property. But first, voters must approve this project at the ballot box May 16th. There was a long and sometimes rancorous debate Wednesday about the project. It needed two-thirds of the vote, and it got it. One woman, Carol Murphy, called the two-story building a poor choice for seniors. But Brenda Swain from the Council on Aging said, she's a board member of the Council on Aging, said the bottom line is the town needs this new senior center.
Now, this has been kind of a circuitous route in deciding on a location for this. There have been all kinds of locations suggested in the past little while, including, you know, the Coonamesset Inn when that was up for sale last year.
That's right. And this project is also, this newly approved senior center, it has taken some heat from pickleball players. We were talking about pickleball earlier because it doesn't have a gym for the pickleball players. It's become a very popular sport among seniors. And now the interesting thing, this will be funded by a temporary tax increase, but it won't show up on your tax bill in Falmouth because other long-term debt is being paid off.
Okay. Other Falmouth news, the town meeting has taken steps toward the purchase of a farm in town.
Yes, a special town meeting on Tuesday, and it gave selectmen the okay to negotiate with the Andrews family for 36.7 acres. This is a historic Tony Andrews farm in East Falmouth, and this was started by the late Tony and Marina Andrews. The Andrews son put the farm up for sale last year. Now, the town, the Andrews family has announced Tuesday it's agreed to offer the land for $2 million, which was down from its $2.2 million asking price. It's part of a package deal. The 300 Committee Land Trust, which is a nonprofit, plans to purchase an additional 10 acres on a pond also owned by the Andrews family. That's priced at $950,000. The 300 Committee Land Trust plans to pay for that with private donations, and the committee will also seek grants to help the town cover the cost of those 36-plus acres. And they say that town meeting members will be asked in November to cover any shortfall, but they really hope to get a bunch of grants from a variety of sources to make up most of that money.
Now, some people are, I guess, holding out hope that this farm could continue to run as a farm. Is that, you know?
Yeah, well, it dates back to the 1930s, and it's known for its strawberries and vegetables. And some people, yeah, definitely want to see this continue running as a working farm.
Okay. Turning now to Wellfleet, we have a story. You have a story in the paper this week about a kite surfer who has now dropped a lawsuit after part of the beach has now been opened up to that sport.
Yes, this kite surfer Holly Kuhn, and she and other kite surfers really want to hit the Atlantic. And what happened was that previously, since 2014, kite surfers in the Lower Cape have been largely squeezed into a patch of beach on Cape Cod Bay and Wellfleet. But they're like eyeing those bigger waves out in the Atlantic. They use 15-foot-wide kites to go out far in the water. They release the tension and ride the waves in, and the Atlantic just provides a better playground for them. So Kuhn filed a lawsuit in June alleging that the Cape Cod National Seashore's limits on kite surfing were unfair compared to other sports that it allowed. There was restrictions based on claims of harm to shorebirds, but Kuhn is saying that there's little evidence backing that up. And indeed, the National Seashore ruled on March 6th that to open an area in Eastham, they determined that the beach there was too narrow for shorebird nesting, and actually it hadn't supported any nests in 15 years. So Kuhn's federal lawsuit was dismissed March 27th, and she's hoping that the seashore will find more narrow beaches in the future where these birds aren't actually nesting and give kite surfers year-round access.
I guess it's just about time to start that sport up again. I guess we'll see how that goes as we get into spring and summer. Cindy, another beach-related story that you guys had in the paper this week. Coast Guard Beach has once again emerged victorious in a new online poll of the best beaches on Cape Cod.
Yeah, this is Coast Guard Beach in Eastham, and it wins lots of contests, and it won one from the Cape Cod Times, the Cape Cod Beach Bracket Challenge that got 7,200 votes came into this contest on CapeCodTimes.com. Now, the competition started with 32 sandy favorites, but then the final competitors were pitted against each other were First Encounter Beach, also in Eastham on Cape Cod Bay, but Coast Guard Beach ended up getting almost twice as many votes in the finals. And this beach is, very popular. It draws more than 300,000 visits each season, according to the Cape Cod National Seashore. And the attractions include, the water, but also marshland, birds, and other wildlife.
What was the criteria that was part of the poll? Like, what was the poll asking about?
It was just asking for people's favorites. And, it's interesting because there's, you've heard of Dr. Beach. He's a professor from Florida International University. His real name is Stephen Leatherman. And he does an annual poll he does an annual listing of what he considers the best beaches in the whole United States. And Coast Guard Beach always just has made this list year after year. He says it's one of the best swimming beaches. He also says it's well guarded, which I guess is important in case there's any rip currents and in case there's any sharks.
That's a big consideration these days on the Cape.
Yeah. So what's your favorite beach?
Well, Coast Guard is definitely up there. I think Marconi and Wellfleet.
I was going to say Marconi. Absolutely. Gorgeous.
Yeah. Okay, I want to thank Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com who came into the studio today for the roundup. Thanks, Cindy.
You're welcome.
And also many thanks to our other contributors today, Sam Houghton of the Mashpee Enterprise, Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times, and George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And I'd like to thank all of you for listening. I'm Brian Morris.
The Friday News Roundup is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.